The following message is copyrighted by Westminster Theological Seminary. Duplication, distribution, or other use of all or any part of this message is not permitted without prior written consent. Please direct your inquiries to communications@wts.edu. For all other information, please visit the main website at www.wts.edu.
We begin today. I've given to you really an article that I had written about, I can't believe it already, 13 years ago, I guess, when it was published. I can't believe it's that long already, but so it is. And this comes from the Westminster Theological Journal, spring 1981. That's where you can find it. It's volume 43. And in our lecture for today, we're going to work through this again as one of the perspectives on Lutheran orthodoxy. Last two sessions together, we've been looking at the struggle between Melanchthon's Augsburg Confession as it was influencing the politics of Europe, specifically Calvin's France, and Calvin's attempt to deal with the intrusion, as he saw it, of Lutheranism into France. The international repercussions of that was significant. And we noted that the unity of Reformed expression at that point was not evident at all. In fact, it was seen as a grave danger for France. And so that shows us then that Lutheranism, not just in terms of the Lord's Supper alone, but in a broader sense, as it was developed, was seen as an incomplete form of theology for a Reformed perspective. Today, what we're going to look at is one of the great milestones in the development of Reformed theology, that is the emergence of the covenant of works or the covenant of creation from the pen of Ursinus. And the question that we have to deal with here again is, in what way was Melanchthonian theology now impacting Reformed theology positively, if it can be seen that way? So the question is, Melanchthon had his impact on Lutheranism. We saw that when we looked at the formula of Concord, and we realized that many of the debates that occurred there were as a result of Melanchthon's influence on Lutheranism. So now we're looking at Melanchthon's impact upon the Reform system, and that's where we're zeroing in today, specifically on the question of Ursinus's development of the covenant of creation, a debt to Melanchthon or Calvin. So that's the first thing by way of introduction. Most of us know the name of Zacharias Ursinus because of his co-authorship of the Heidelberg Catechism. He worked with the Levianus, and that, of course, is still a living document in Reformed theology. What is significant at this point is that many interpreters of the Heidelberg Catechism have noted that it has a very warm and gentle pastoral spirit. And there is something very true about that. It's designed in such a way that it really touches the heart as well as the mind. The Westminster Catechism, is to use a word that Warfield has, is that it's nervous, it's tense, it's precise, and the idea is that it is much more intellectual in character, it seems to me. Not that it doesn't have a practical side to it. Comment. It doesn't mean in the negative sense, if you will. It's not a pejorative term, but it means the more it has an intensity to it, something along those lines. It's not more of the gentle, practical kind of thing, but it's designed to be very succinct and to the point, okay? And I think that's what the idea means. And as we look at that concept, therefore, it's evident to me that one of the great contributions of Ursinus has been largely overlooked to most people, and that is that to his credit, we can find for the first time in print the development of the notion of a pre-fall covenant explicitly declared. And where we see that here is, you look at the outline, it's in the Summa Theologiae of 1562, which actually was a catechism developed by Ursinus 1 year before the Heidelberg Catechism. And in there, in questions 10 and 36, he uses the phrase creatione fidus. Or in the second number 36 there, it says, a fidus naturale in creatione. So there's this idea of a creation covenant or covenant of nature. And in the context, he's developing the notion of the law of God. So the idea is that God's moral law was in the garden with Adam. It was a natural covenantal relationship, and it involved the benefit of life or the curse of death, depending upon observance or disobedience. And so as you reflect on the quotes here, you'll notice that there's very much a continuity in the first question. What does the law of God teach? It's clear that the law of God is the same from before creation, after the fall, into redemption. There's no change. The moral law has been the same. And that first covenant brought with it, according to question 36, you notice the last part, it says it promised eternal life, and in the non-performance, it brought about, if you will, eternal punishment or death. So that the idea of the law and gospel, then, according to the question number 36, what is the difference between law and gospel? It has to do whether is there benefit for keeping the law or not. In the gospel, it's not a law-centered orientation. It is a gospel orientation. But it's that idea that the covenant in creation is where the law first finds its expression, and it has with it, in the unfallen state, the benefit of life or the curse of death. And for the man who's in sin today, he stands under death because of the breaking of the covenant of works. So that's the beginning stage, if you will, of the concept of the covenant of works and Reformed theology. The question is, does it exist earlier? And where does the impetus come for this? Now, one of the things that I was amazed when I started doing research on this several years ago, and what I'm trying to reflect in this article, is that many continental theologians say that this is really Melanchthonian natural law theology making its impression felt upon Reformed theology. Okay, so if you flip over a few pages, we can see some of the examples of the continental theologians that have claimed that this is very much Melanchthonian in character. See if I have a list. On page 254, if you'll take a look at that footnote 22, you'll find Paul Althaus, Karl Barth, August Long, J. Moltmann, Otto Ritschl, Gottlob Schrenk as an example, and also I have there the name Erdmann Sturm, all of whom say that the impetus for this development is from Melanchthonian thinking. So those are some pretty heavyweight historical and systematic theologians from the continental tradition who said basically the Reformed development of the covenant of works or covenant of creation is from Melanchthon. So what we're doing here then in this discussion is to ask the question, is it legitimate to look to that connection? And it raises some interesting questions for those that have a Reformed interest to say, you mean one of the basic rubrics of our system comes from really Melanchthonian, perhaps synergism, which is part of the question. Is this an attempt to soften Reformed orthodoxy and its strong emphasis on sovereign grace by putting into it something of a human response? You see, that's what the covenant of works is. And you can see that's one of the questions that might be there. Now, before we tackle that question, let's pick up a little bit of the history of how Ursinus may have been influenced by Melanchthonian thought. So we go back to page 248. The first full paragraph says, with such an important breakthrough, the question of what stimulated Ursinus to think along these lines naturally arises. The most popular position among German scholars is to attribute Ursinus's theological development to Melanchthonian influences. Such a connection has considerable presumptive support in that Ursinus was a student of Melanchthon for 7 years and enjoyed a close relationship of mutual esteem and friendship. It is also known that Ursinus used Melanchthon's Examen Ordinandorum while he taught at the Elisabeter Gymnasium in Wittenberg. So you see that there was some significant influence in Melanchthon's teaching and writing upon Ursinus. He actually used one of his writings, and he actually was a student. So here's, at least from a historical vantage point, an opportunity for Melanchthonian influence to be impressed upon Ursinus. And then also, when the crypto-Calvinism controversy occurred in 1559 and 60, and it brought reproach for Melanchthon, Ursinus remained faithful to his teacher's Eucharistic teaching. So in other words, there was a clear sense that he was, if you will, a crypto-Calvinist, or really a Calvinist. Ursinus was in the Reformed tradition. And he only left Wittenberg after Melanchthon died in 1560. In other words, Ursinus was teaching in the very shadow of Melanchthon, and he only left that area in the school after Melanchthon's death. So he was a loyal friend. Okay? So then, continue on. The earlier form of this position, that is, of the influence on Melanchthon upon Ursinus, was taken by Heinrich Heppe. And Heppe is one of the great historical writers. His work is Dogmatik des Deutschen Protestantismus in the 16th century, if you will, to translate it there. And so his idea was that the heart of German Reformed theology was a rejuvenation of Melanchthonian theology, and that it united in its opposition to the Calvinistic doctrine of predestination. Okay, so what we have here is Heppe's claim that there was an attempt to soften Calvinism in Germany using the vehicle of Melanchthonian thought, and that Ursinus is one of the key players in that. So from a historical vantage point, what we're seeing is, as Lutheran orthodoxy is developing under Melanchthon, and it's taking its Melanchthonian shape, that it had a tremendous impact upon German Reformed theology through Ursinus. And one of the byproducts of that is the softening of the predestinarian covenant of grace theology by positing a pre-fall covenant where man had a role to play. You see, remember the synergism of Melanchthon? This is an attempt, according to some scholars, for the covenant of works to bring in some kind of a softening of predestination into Reformed theology. It's a fascinating thought, especially since you recognize that in the Westminster Confession and Catechism, the covenant of works makes the, they make the covenant of works a foundational concept. So you can see it's a fascinating question, right? Now we go on, next paragraph. Heppe has received several pointed criticisms of historical analysis of German Reformed covenant theology that appear to be unassailable. So I'm giving these criticisms some significant weight. For example, Philip Schaff has argued that this view is one-sided and fails to take into consideration the influence of other key Reformed leaders such as Zwingli and Calvin on the development of the German Reformed theology. And of course, I would fully agree with that. Paul Althaus has pointed out that the covenant idea was being used extensively by Calvin and Bullinger before the emergence of the German Reformed theology. So what Heppe was trying to do almost was to say that this development of covenantal thought was to just bring synergism, if you will, of Melanchthon somehow to bear fully upon Reformed theology. And we can't say that because we realize that the predestinarianism of Zwingli and Calvin used covenant. But the milder question of, is the covenant of works a legitimate Melanchthonian impress of man's working together with God in covenant with, if you will, some kind of synergism? Is that a legitimate claim? And that's what we want to explore more fully in our lecture today and what this article that I have here zeroes in on. So the next paragraph. Undoubtedly, Melanchthon's synergistic tendency of including the human will in the causes of conversion and dismissing the doctrine of predestination as a dangerous vestige of Stoic philosophy might have been able to employ the covenant idea to strengthen its perspective. Melanchthon, however, never used the covenant idea in this manner, and it has been just been pointed out this cannot be found in the German Reformed theologians either. So that first brush of idea, well, really the covenant system was an attempt to bring Melanchthonian synergism to bear on Reformed theology. Point one, you never find, as far as I can tell, Melanchthon ever doing that himself. He doesn't say, well, let's take the covenant idea and argue for synergism from this idea of mutuality. We don't find it. And further, you cannot find that model being explicitly used in German Reformed theology. Okay? Now, just a couple other points of some other writers who have developed some of these notions. You drop down in the paragraph. It says, the propensity to establish a dichotomy between predestination and covenant theology has been manifested by other analysts of Reformed theology. Gottlob Schrenk argues that Bullinger's use of the covenant idea is to establish a universality in the face of the prevailing rigid predestinarianism. Now, Gottlob Schrenk, if you look below at his writing, Gottes Reich und Bund im älteren Protestantismus, is a classic work. It was one of the great treatises that developed the early scholarly attempt to analyze the development of Reformed covenantalism. And I think it's significant that he is willing to say that Bullinger was the one that we need to look at who is trying to tone down predestination. And that idea is still being used by scholars to this day who say that Bullinger taught instead of a double predestination, only a single predestination. He didn't teach reprobation and other things. The problem with that, by the way, the scholar that holds that view is J. Wayne Baker in his book on the tradition of Bullinger and the covenant. The problem with that view is that when you go back and look at the full writings of Bullinger, in his Second Helvetic Confession, he teaches reprobation, which is amazing to me that you can have such a strong view taught by scholars. And in his very confessional document that is actually a tertiary standard of many of the Reformed churches, he clearly develops the doctrine of reprobation in it. So you say, well, how can you claim such a statement? But it shows me again that great scholars make claims that they cannot substantiate. This is a thing that bothers me. And one of the things that tends to make me overkill when I do research is that I don't want people to come along and say, well, didn't you bother to read this famous treatise on such and such before you made your statement? And that's one of the things I want you to hear, is that when you go to do your work and you're writing something and you try to be as definitive as you can be, because I don't think this statement is possible to make if you've read all of Bullinger's writing. You come away and say, he believed. You may be able to say he changed his mind. Okay, maybe that's true. But you ought to at least be able to say, well, later on, he did teach reprobation. And he never recanted of his covenantal thought. So somehow he must have thought they went together, at least later, if he didn't earlier. But the idea seems to be that it was developed to tone it down. Well, if that's true, why do we find him teaching reprobation in his confession of faith, Second Helvetic Confession? That needs to be asked. Well, the scholars kind of ignore some of these things. It seems to me J. Wayne Baker has ignored this, and he's writing as recently as in the last 15 years. Okay. All right, J. A. Dorner, an apologist for the dispensational hermeneutics such as Fred Lincoln and Charles Ryrie, placed this tension of covenant and predestination as first arising with the confrontation of Coxeus. So, I mean, there's another system of dealing with it. And we won't pursue that today, although in the article I take some time to turn attention to that. Okay. My concern, however, is to really look at the Melanchthonian influences. So let's turn back to page 254. And I've mentioned some of the scholars. I cite them in footnote 22, and I've mentioned their names earlier. And I carry on at the top of the page by saying, thus the consensus of recent scholarship would appear to favor the connection between Melanchthon and Ursinus with respect to his formulation of the covenant of nature. In other words, the question then is, where in the world did Ursinus come up with the idea of developing a notion of covenant of works or covenant of creation? And if we look at the continental scholars, they would say we should look to Melanchthon's theology. And that's where it's going to come from. Okay? And there appear to be three key assertions of Melanchthonian influence that would bear as Melanchthonian theology makes its impression on Reformed thought. The first is the idea of natural law. Okay, it's very clear when you look at those two catechetical questions of Ursinus that he's saying there's a continuity of law from the covenant of nature, that is natural law, all the way through the giving of the law, man's sinfulness and God's redemption, and then living a Christian life from a Reformed perspective is living out law as part of it, and sanctification. There's continuity, and it goes back to the idea of natural law. And the continental theologians say that is a product of Melanchthon's thought natural law theology. Okay? By the way, that's a very relevant concept even to this day, to this appointment of Supreme Court justices in the American system. The question came up is, what is your theory of law? Is it natural law and that sort of thing? So some of these ideas are still current when you wrestle with them. Okay, the second influence is this law-gospel dichotomy. It's clear that the law-gospel distinction is right at the heart of Lutheran theology. And now the claim is that the law-gospel dichotomy is mediated through Melanchthon from Luther in such a way that it makes it a kind of an impression upon Ursinus that helps him craft a natural law and a law-gospel dichotomy in a covenant of works, covenant of grace scenario. Okay, and we get that from there. And then the third possibility is the development of the sacrament of baptism under the category of a covenantal baptism. And that also may have had its influence on their thinking. Now, what we have to do in our time today then, excuse me, is attempt to explain in what unique ways were there natural law conceptions and law-gospel dichotomy conceptions that are unique to Melanchthon that we can find bearing themselves on Ursinus and thereby bringing about the covenant. Okay? So let's begin looking at some of these ideas. So the first quote here is now Lang, as he writes, and I'm translating him. He says, "Ursinus discovered the creation covenant, whose content is later repeated by the law, which was a development otherwise unparalleled by the other reformers." Okay, it's a bold statement. In other words, Ursinus, in his covenant of creation, discovers in this covenant a repetition of the law in the later giving of the law that was also in the creation account, which is unparalleled in the other reformers. This is something new. We will not find it, he is claiming, in Calvin or the Zurich theologians. This is something different in Reformed theology, a new direction. This can be explained, he says, only by Melanchthon, who in his loci, and then he gives the reference, like Ursinus, places the law of nature on a par with the innate imago Dei and with the revealed law in the narrower sense. He says it is in the unique image of God theology of Melanchthon and in his understanding of the revelation of the law in that unfallen state and its continuity with the law given later in Melanchthon that gives its impression on Ursinus. Okay? Now, Calvin, however, as he goes on, cannot be seen to be an exponent of such a conception. And Lang writes, "Calvin does not want to know much concerning the darkened law of nature." In other words, the law of nature does not have any significance in Calvin's theology. This is something of Melanchthon coming into Reformed thought through Ursinus. Again, Althaus, another one of our writers, will say, "The Institutes was very reserved," as another expression. Calvin speaks therein indeed of the law of nature and maintains the principle of the identity of the inner law with the Decalogue. But even stronger, he stresses the empirical depravity of the moral judgments, on account of which the law of Scripture was necessary. Moreover, he did not think thereby to identify the legal covenant with a covenant of nature or covenant of creation. Now, there's some important points there. We need to unpack that quote. What Althaus is claiming here is, first of all, that we need to recognize that in Calvin's theology of man's sinfulness, his fallenness, that he does not want to look at man's nature as a place of finding a creational covenant. He says that we ought not to look at this area of man because man's sin will destroy any value of that covenant of creation in the heart. And then further, he says that Calvin never identifies a legal covenant, that is of the Mosaic era, with a covenant of nature or covenant of creation. That for Calvin, the Mosaic covenant is a new historical redemptive phenomenon, and there is no sense that he will connect that with what went on in the covenant of creation. That's Althaus's claim, that we cannot find the connection between the two. And to find the connection between the two, we have to look to Melanchthon. Okay, Calvin will not connect them. Melanchthon will. And therefore, here's a proof of Melanchthonian influence. Okay? Now, it is significant that Lange had said earlier that there is an unparalleled, or this idea of the covenant of law in Ursinus is unparalleled, although that is softened slightly here by Althaus, who said Calvin speaks therein indeed of the law of nature and maintains the principle of the identity of the inner law with the Decalogue. So I think Althaus has read a little more of Calvin than Lange had, in my opinion, because he's right. There is continuity here. But what Althaus is trying to argue is that there is a clear distinguishing between the two, that we don't see the Mosaic covenant of law paralleled or in continuity with that pre-fall covenant experience. Okay? Let me just take a couple minutes since we started late, and then we'll take a break. Let's continue on. He says, in accord with Althaus's comment on Calvin's use of the legal covenant, and the Latin phrase is fidus legale, Sturm will write, in other words, there's another author who will take the same view, Erdmann Sturm, and his point is, while it is true that one can find the idea of the fidus legale in Calvin, it is not used in the sense of the fidus creationis. Okay? In other words, the legal covenant cannot be used in the same way as the covenant of creation in Calvin. They are not the same. And that is what is necessary for there to be this development of a covenant of works in the concept of Ursinus. So they're not the same. Here the word law signifies God's revealed law, but not natural law. The fidus legale is the covenant with Moses. Over against this, Ursinus' idea of the creation covenant is oriented toward Melanchthon's doctrine of natural law. Okay, so I wanted to give you a little bit of the flavor of how these continental scholars are arguing, so that they're at least saying, yes, Calvin will use the phrase, the covenant of law. That's found in his writings. But he never will use the phrase with the notion of a pre-fall existence. It has only a reference to the moral law at Sinai given to Moses. However, Ursinus clearly sees that covenant as a continuing covenant. And the only explanation for that is the natural law concept of Melanchthon being mediated through the Reformed thinking of Ursinus. And therefore, we owe the dual covenant system to Melanchthon's influence on Reformed theology. Okay? So that's the thesis that they are presenting to us. Now, what I want to do is to challenge it for a number of reasons. First of all, it bothered me when I first began to read these men and say, you mean I have to say that Reformed orthodoxy is really Melanchthon's work, product, as its media? That troubles me because Melanchthon is such a confusing figure to start with. The second thing is that can we show that there is something uniquely Melanchthonian about these concepts? Or can we say that the development, which I think is a real development by Ursinus, he is the one who first articulates this concept, is it a legitimate development of a concept that's implicit in Calvinism that he is, if you will, bringing to maturity? So I'm going to challenge the continental scholars by saying, I think you're looking at something you can find some parallel with in Melanchthon. And yes, Ursinus is developing something that is mature, but I'm going to say that the debt can really be found in Calvin's thought rather than Melanchthon's thought. And to the extent that is Melanchthonian, it's because it is a common coin shared by reformers in general. Okay? That's my thesis that I'm presenting here. Now, just so you know, since this was written 13 years ago or whatever it was, there's been at least a few people who've taken time to read it and interact with me. And it's encouraging that there is apparently an author whose name I don't have in front of me now who's just writing a book that's going to be published by the Oxford University Press, who said, I've researched this area and I agree with you. May I quote your paper? So I know at least one scholar has come along and said, I think you're right. I don't know if anybody else in the world has, but at least one has come along and agreed with this general principle. Now, there's been another work that's been written recently, and I've His name is David Weir, who wrote an interesting work on the historical beginnings of federalism. And he takes the view that Calvin is not to be seen as the influence. And he criticizes my position. And that is in print, and you can, if you'd like to read that, it's in the library. Now, as I look at what Weir does, though, is he basically dismisses the entire argument without as much as evaluating it. So it's kind of like, I disagree, and on I go. And I'm not sure if it's going to be in print, but you may want to be watching for the Calvin Theological Journal that's coming out in April. I've written an article called The Continuing Conundrum of Calvin and the Conditionality of the Covenant, where I interact a little bit with Weir and some of the other contemporary writers. And in there I point out that there's a lot of information that he just does not deal with. And when we come back, we're going to try to look at some of the evidence that argues for Calvin's contribution to the covenant of works. Now, the reason that I'm unclear if it's going to be printed is that they never told me they're going to use it, but they asked me to write it, and I sent it off, and I've never heard they haven't. So I'm assuming it's going to be there in the Calvin Theological Journal in April. And if it's not, then to the tape and to the class, I apologize. I'm assuming it's there because they asked me to write it. But nevertheless, the point here is that there is a legitimacy of challenging the notion. And when we come back, I want to begin to pick up with the argument of showing what arguments have been used to claim that we, from the Reform side, are indebted to Melanchthon. And then I want to come back and show you some of the evidence that would say we really should look to Calvin and a common tradition at some point where there were things that were really in union between Melanchthon and Calvin and others. Okay? So we'll pick up in, let's say, 5 to 7 minutes. We'll be back. All right. Well, the point is, as we begin to look specifically at some of the evidence that are from the continental scholars for the Melanchthonian influence, let's jump down to page 259, the first Roman numeral, and I'll allow you to look at some of the other scholarly information at a later point. And what I'm going to do now is to briefly evaluate these three Melanchthonian influences on Ursinus, because, the thesis that's being offered to us by our continental scholars is that really the covenant of creation is Melanchthonian in character, and Ursinus is the source of this hybridization of Lutheran Reformed theology, which creates a third entity, which is German Reformed theology. And so that we can say that the views of the Westminster Confession that takes a covenant of works and puts it in tension with a covenant of grace is really a non-Calvinistic way of thinking. It is a change, a movement away. And from my viewpoint, I want to argue rather that it is a development of implicit and seed ideas in Calvin that are brought out legitimately. Okay, so that's a very different model. You can see why it's written from an apologetical viewpoint. Since I'm Presbyterian and Reformed and I hold the Westminster Confession, I'm troubled when someone tells me that a synergistic motive is what produced my confession of faith when I believe in sovereign grace. Okay, so they can see why I'm apologetic here in that sense. All right, the first issue to be considered is whether the doctrine of natural law, as expressed by Melanchthon, is in some way unique to him, such that if it were found in Ursinus, it would have to be termed Melanchthonian natural law. So that's the first question we're raising. Is this natural law concept explicitly and uniquely Melanchthonian, so that it's legitimate to use that adjective in an exclusive sense? Now, what I first do here, and we won't take time to try to translate all the Latin, etc., but the issue is that it's clear that Melanchthon has a view of natural law in man's initial state in paradise, that natural law is present. That's the point of the first quote. And go on. It is important to realize, however, that such a perspective on natural law is found also in Melanchthon's mentor, Luther. Melanchthon had expressed his view as cited above in 1543 edition of the Loci. Luther had expressed himself with equal clarity in 1538. So the quote says, "Circumcision and other ceremonies belong to a certain people and to a certain time, Then they came completely to an end. The Decalogue is indeed now attached to conscience. For if God had never established the law through Moses, the natural human mind would still have this notion to worship God and to esteem him highly. And then again in 1539, citing Romans 2, 14 and 15, he will say that there is this natural law that comes to us from God's creative work, okay, and the conscience of man. So the first thing that we need to see here then is that if this is a Lutheran concept as well as a Melanchthonian, Luther clearly was not motivated by synergism. In fact, it was exactly the opposite. The bondage of the will was the position that he took of God's sovereign grace. All right, so that's an important point. It therefore lessens the thought that this is Melanchthonian natural law. And the concept of natural law and the linkage between moral law and conscience and creation are connected by Luther. But notice further. We can go down. Page 261. That Calvin connects this with the image of God is demonstrated, and this is now coming from his commentary on John 3, 6. The quote, "The gifts which God hath left to us since the fall, if they are judged by themselves, are indeed worthy of praise. But as the contagion of wickedness is spread through every part, there will be found in us nothing that is pure and free from every defilement. That we naturally possess some knowledge of God, that some distinction between good and evil is engraven on our conscience, that our faculties are sufficient for the maintenance of the present life, that in short we are so many ways superior to the brute beasts, that is excellent in itself, so far as it proceeds from God, but in us all these things are completely polluted." Now, what do you find there? Calvin is basically saying that there is a knowledge of God and gifts that come from creation that continue into man's conscience even today after the fall. They're polluted. Well, so would Melanchthon and Luther said the same. They're polluted. They're sin. But there is still something that's glorious about man's nature that comes from creation that includes this idea of conscience and the sense of God's law graved upon them. Okay, so it becomes evident that Melanchthon did not have a monopoly upon the concept of natural law. The next paragraph. The chief objection to seeing the presence of a proper type of natural law in Calvin that would result in a creation covenant was that Calvin depreciated the function of natural law to too great an extent due to sin. Okay, the idea then, you remember one of the earlier writers said, well, it's in Calvin, but, you know, it's because of his emphasis on the sinfulness of man, which we see right here in the quote we just had, that it discounts any possibility that he could look in this way at the continuity of a covenant of creation with a covenant of grace. But the point here is that apparently Lang and Althaus failed to recognize that this same point is made by Melanchthon in every edition of his Loci. Isn't that interesting? I actually checked them out as every edition all the way through. And in 1521, in discussing natural law, this is early, he says, "For in general, the judgment of human comprehension is fallacious because of our innate blindness, so that even if certain patterns of morals have been engraved on our minds, they can scarcely be apprehended." Now, you know, that sounds like Calvin could have written that statement. Okay? Depravity is at work. Similar comments can be found in the editions of 1535, 1543, and even in the final 1555 edition of the Loci Communes. Thus, even after Melanchthon's softening of the earlier position he had maintained with respect to free will, he still denied any real value to man's natural law knowledge because of the effects of sin. And listen to what he says in 1555, after he's begun a synergistic approach. He says, "Now one might ask, since an understanding of the Ten Commandments is implanted in all men at their creation, why then did God proclaim the Ten Commandments with so many great miracles before so many hundreds of thousands of men? Answer, there are many important reasons for this open magistral proclamation, but two are especially important. In the wake of sin, the light in human reason was not as clear and bright as before. Men became ever more shameless and savage and incurred more blindness. The heathen invented and invoked many eternal beings and repugnant gods. They permitted all sorts of frightful immorality and did not record it as vice. Against such blindness, God not only proclaimed his law on Mount Sinai, but has sustained and upheld it since the time of Adam in his church. Now that statement again emphasizes the fact that this law has been incapacitated for man, left to itself. So we might say, well, how does that fit with Melanchthon synergism? Well, the point that I want to say is that he doesn't address that precisely here. But the notion that sin has destroyed its ability in and of itself is evident. Comment. Well, what it says is that the moral law in its revealed form has always been the paramount form, but it was anticipated in some sense in natural law. So it gives the word reinforcement, going back to Adam, says that the law given at Sinai is primary. The natural law is secondary because it reflects this revealed code in its most explicit form. And that language, in fact, is very valuable because that's pretty much one of the points that Calvin is going to make and one of the arguments that people try to say why he couldn't have had a covenant of creation idea in mind because of his use of the phrase fidus legale as being only Mosaic in character. But what you can see is that there's an emphasis on the priority of that, even in this quote by Melanchthon, which helps lessen the distance between the two positions. Okay, but that's worthy of further thinking. Now we can. There are several other things that I want to remark on, or I could remark on that I'm not going to take time to interact with the character, the sinfulness of man's thought in terms of Lutheran and Melanchthonian theology. But it's here in the article, and I'll let you pursue that on your own. But let's jump down to 264 to the bottom to take a look at the second major argument that's been used. The second suggested Melanchthonian influence upon Ursinus's development of the covenant of creation is his sharp law-gospel distinction. Okay. Melanchthon's expression of this is as follows, and now we're quoting again from his Loci Communis. He says, generally speaking, there are two parts to Scripture, law and gospel. The law shows sin, the gospel grace. The law indicates disease, the gospel points out the remedy. To use Paul's words, the law is the minister of death. The gospel is the minister of life and peace. Again, however, this important hermeneutical device is in no way unique to Melanchthon. Luther, writing against Erasmus, stated, so obviously we know that Luther says that's the sum of his divinity. Okay, so we don't have to spend a lot of time, hopefully, in this class on how important law gospel is. For Luther, we could find a great deal of that. But go on to page 266 now, or the first full paragraph again says, Calvin maintained his assistance upon the unity of the covenants and the simultaneous distinction of law and gospel with remarkable consistency and clarity throughout his writings. Okay, what am I saying? That what we're going to find is that Calvin was able to recognize a legitimacy for the law-gospel distinction, but in a sense that does not move him in the Lutheran model, which we spoke about, so that he could maintain some kind of a biblical unity, and yet there still is a law-gospel distinction that works in Calvin's theology. We might ask the question, where do we find that? Well, if you go back to 263 at the bottom here, excuse me, that's the wrong page. The bottom of page 265. This quote now is coming from Calvin's commentary on Romans 10:4. And it reads, the promises of the gospel, however, are found only here and there in the writings of Moses. Excuse me, I'm reading Luther here, aren't I? Let me just jump down to the next quote so I don't confuse our argument. I'm losing my track here. But what I want to say basically then is that for Calvin's writings, I think, which we've looked at earlier in the course, that law gospel for him has tremendous force when we're talking about a man in sin. Before a man comes to Christ, there is a clear break between law and gospel. But once a man comes to Christ, the law-gospel distinction becomes now the continuity of the letter and spirit, because the letter of the law now becomes spiritual. That is the issue that where Calvin begins to be distinct. Larry, you're going to make a comment there. That's what I thought. I didn't want to read it without double-checking the note. What that long quote does for us is it shows us his commitment to the concept of the law-gospel distinction. Okay, it's present there. The issue then is, while there's a clear difference between law-gospel and letter-spirit, there still is, at the point of where Calvin uses law-gospel, a simultaneous connection with the Lutheran model in that, for both systems, a man, before he comes to Christ, must repent of his sin, and the law is used to condemn man in sin to bring him to the gospel. Once he comes to Christ, the law-gospel distinction changes into the letter of the law becomes the spirit, where the law is written on the heart. Okay? So now listen, this is where we come to what I think is the most telling objection to the viewpoint of trying to argue that there is room for this in Calvin's theology. At the middle of 266, it says, Calvin maintained his insistence upon the unity of the covenants, as I've said earlier, and their simultaneous distinction of law and gospel with remarkable consistency and clarity throughout his writings. The question of Calvin's use of fides legale in relation to the covenant of creation raised by Althaus and Sturm above is the one that I want us to think about now. Okay, so if you jump over a few pages, let's see where if I can find where in Calvin I pick that up. It's a little bit later in the last section of the article here. Turn to page 283. Okay, and this is where in the article I come back to now to develop how Calvin uses this concept. Okay, and for the sake of our lecture, it makes sense to go to this at this point. Now, the point that we have to ask is it true what Althaus and Sturm have claimed, that when Calvin uses the phrase of fides legale, that he only means the Mosaic covenant? Does he ever have room for it in his system to think of that phrase being used of a covenant before man's fall into sin? Okay. Before we look at the specific context of the fides legale in 283, go back a little bit further to the bottom of 284. And I think this is important to have in our backdrop as we look at Calvin's thinking. Notice at the bottom where it says, one final aspect of Calvin's treatment of the pre-fall situation that argues for a covenant of works in Calvin is the presence of a sacrament. Okay? So now, my point is that Calvin is going to begin to present his view of this early situation of Adam in paradise. And he's going to say that there are sacraments there in that place. And then we're going to say, well, what is required for Calvin for sacraments to be present? And we're going to discover that for Calvin there has to be a covenant for there to be a sacrament. And we're going to begin to see the context in which we can see that Calvin had the notion of a covenant relationship in the garden, okay? And then we're going to see how we can connect that with the idea of a fides legale, or a covenant of law, something along the ideas of a covenant of creation. So he says, now I'm quoting 119 Genesis 2:9. So he's actually expounding in the commentary that passage. Quote, he gave the tree of life its name, not because it could confer on man that life with which he had been previously endued, but in order that it might be a symbol and memorial of the life which he had received from God. For we know it to be by no means unusual that God should give to us the attestation of his grace by external symbols. He does not indeed transfer his power into outward signs, but by them he stretches out his hand to us, because without assistance we cannot ascend to him. So what we're seeing there is that Calvin is saying there are symbols at work that are the means of grace, but are not ex opere operato grace, if you will. So he's beginning to develop the idea of symbol, memorial, external signs, power. That's all his sacramental theology. Now notice further, as he explains the tree of life, top of 285. Yet I am not dissatisfied with what has been handed down by some of the fathers, as Augustine and Eucharius, that the tree of life was a figure of Christ, inasmuch as he is the eternal word of God. It could not indeed be otherwise a symbol of life than by representing him in figures. So now Christ is present in some way, represented from this. And then we go on to the next quote. And as Adam and Eve are driven from the garden, he says, we know what is the efficacy of sacraments. Okay, so now he actually uses the word sacrament. He says, and it was said above that the tree was given as a pledge of life. Wherefore, that he might understand himself to be deprived of his former life, a solemn excommunication is added. Not that the Lord would cut him off from all hope of salvation, but by taking away what he had given, would cause man to seek new assistance elsewhere. Now, what's his point? We see Calvin's sacramental theology painted into the garden as he is expounding. He's saying there is a tree of life, which is a sign, a symbol, a memorial representing Christ. And when sin entered the world, they were excommunicated. They were driven from the communion table of the tree. That's what he's saying. Now, the next quote I want you to think about comes from his commentary on 1 Corinthians 11:25, found at the bottom of page 285. Calvin writes, it is well known, however, that sacraments receive that name from being testimonies to us of the divine will to confirm it in our minds. For as a covenant is entered into among men with solemn rites, so it is in the same manner that the Lord deals with us. Nor is it without strict propriety that this term is employed. For in consequence of the connection between the word and the sign, the covenant of the Lord is really included in the sacraments. And the term covenant has a reference or relationship to us. This will be of no small importance for understanding the nature of the sacraments. For if they are covenants, then they contain promises by which consciences may be roused up to an assurance of salvation. Okay, now what am I trying to lead you to think here? There is a sacramental life in the garden. Calvin says to understand sacraments, you must realize that that means there is a covenant in place. When we're talking, about the pre-fall existence of man dealing directly with God in sacrament or therefore covenant. In fact, it's interesting when you come down to the next page, page 286, the next quote that I have there. This is now a commentary on Genesis 9:12. The quote says, a sign is added to the promise. This is now the rainbow of the Noahic and flood and covenant, in which is exhibited the wonderful kindness of God, who for the purpose of confirming our faith in his word does not disdain to use such helps. And although we have more fully discussed the use of signs in the second chapter, that is in Genesis 2, where we just were reading, okay, yet we must briefly maintain that these words of Moses are from these words of Moses that is wrong to sever signs from the word. Hence, we also infer that from the beginning, it was the peculiar property of sacraments to avail for the confirmation of faith. For certainly in the covenant, that promise is included to which faith ought to respond. And there he's saying, look, we're talking about the covenant that was there with Adam, it's there with Moses, mirrored by the sacrament. Now the thing that, because I had written this before I had done all my complete research, there is actually, if you, I think I have the reference here, in book 4, I think it's chapter 15, I don't remember, dating from the 1536 edition of the Institutes, he'll actually use the word covenant with respect to Adam. There is one place in the Institutes where he'll go right back to the beginning, his very first edition, and I don't have it in this article because I was still doing my research at this time. And if I'm not mistaken, I think it's book 4, section 15, in one of those sections, he will have the statement that with Adam, God made covenant. So there is, therefore, in Calvin, clearly the notion of a covenant relationship, sacramental life, explicitly called covenant. The theology of covenant and sacrament are intertwined. But more than that now, what about his use of the phrase fidus legale, which is the main argument that was used by Sturm and Althaus. Go ahead. That's right. I think two responses very, very briefly. The first is that's why I think the phrase I emphasized there, that from the beginning, he's mentioned from the second chapter in the context as he's linking the whole concept that he's saying that what I'm talking about here, I'm appealing back to there. And then when you put them together, it's legitimate, it seems to me, to say that we would at least expect him to think of that as a covenant. And then the final proof of it, as I would say, is when you look at the Institutes, which I hadn't read carefully enough when I wrote this some years ago, where he actually will talk about the covenant that God made with Adam.
And which date did you use there?
1536. Yeah, so which is... See, what's significant about that is that Calvin's first edition of the Institutes was, how will I put this, primarily focused on the sacraments. That was his real concern when he started. And so his sacramental thinking was actually rather far along when he wrote. There are a lot of other things he added through the years as he developed it. But he wrote especially to develop his sacramental theology in this first edition of the Institutes. And so right from the beginning, he was already trying to integrate that notion of covenant and Adam, sacramental life, and all these things. Okay, so now the other part that's significant before we look at the phrase is that when you look at a couple other things that Calvin will say about the pre-fall situation, if you go back to page 281, what I wanted to do is to give that backdrop that Calvin actually is thinking of covenant in that context. But then when you begin to see how he begins to develop the law in the pre-fall economy, it begins to trace a little more of the context in which the idea of this being a covenant of law can be developed. Okay, so bottom of page 281. The evidence for a covenant of works in Calvin's theology. Quote, I'm reading now here. Calvin's treatment of Adam's pre-fall state indicates that he considered Adam to be under some sort of a covenant of works. Okay, first, Calvin creates the problem for which a covenant of works is a perfect solution. First, he describes Adam as in a temporary period of innocence. And he, quote, the image of God was only shadowed forth in man till he should arrive at his perfection. Okay, in other words, for Calvin, Adam does not start at perfection in its fullest sense. He is in development. He's without sin. He's morally perfect. But he is not confirmed in an immutable state of perfection. He is innocent. He is right. But it is temporary. And therefore, something can change his state. He's in a changeable situation. Okay, again he writes, the state of man was not perfected in the person of Adam. Adam is perfect in one sense, morally, but he is not perfect in his state. It is mutable. It is changeable. He can lose his position of holiness with God. And before the fall of Adam, man's life was only earthly, seeing it had no firm and settled constancy. What he's saying is that he had no guarantee of eternal life at this stage. He could lose his state of right standing with God. Isn't that interesting? Because it creates the probationary, temporary character of Adam in very strong language. Secondly, Adam was under law, which he kept faithfully, would have led him to a better life of no death. Okay, that sounds very interesting. That the law is present. He's in a temporary situation. If he keeps the law that's given to him, he will move into a state, out of this probationary kind of state, where he would be free from death. Listen to what Calvin says. This is all right out of his commentaries on Genesis 1, 2, and 3. Quote, we now understand what is meant by abstaining from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, namely that Adam might not, in attempting one thing or another, rely upon his own prudence, but that cleaving to God alone, he might become wise only by his obedience. Okay, there is an explicit statement of the fact that the law is significant in this next quote. Notice as he goes on to say, this abstinence was under God's law. Quote, a law is imposed upon him in token of his subjection. For it would have made no difference to God if he had eaten indiscriminately of any fruit he pleased. And so the point is, this was to show Calvin's mind God's sovereignty. He said, it's not something was evil about the tree itself, but it was became the token, representation of God's sovereign power. And he said, this is the law that you must obey this because I have given you my word. So ultimately, Adam would have received life for his obedience. Again, quote, truly the first man would have passed to a better life had he remained upright. But there would have been no separation of the soul from the body, no corruption, no kind of destruction, and in short, no violent change. In other words, without death, he would have entered naturally into a permanent life. And so what he's suggesting then is that there's a temporary period where Adam is given a specific law from God whereby obedience to it will enable him to bypass death and become permanently established in life and relationship to God. That had a covenant. That had a sign. The tree of life had sacramental relationship. So what we have here is some kind of a pre-fall covenant in Calvin. He calls it a covenant. It has a sacrament, and it defines itself on the basis of obedience to law. So there is law present, okay? So now further, as we go along, going back to this whole idea of, to this next section, come to page 283. The first full paragraph of my writing after the second quote there. If Calvin thus sees a legal relationship before and after the fall in which obedience is rewarded with life and disobedience with death, and that the law in both cases is the moral law, because Calvin is prepared, and we didn't develop this here, but you can show from his writings that the moral law continues, it's the same in both areas, then it becomes very difficult to deny that Calvin has a functioning covenant of works. All of the ingredients are present. He's willing to call it a covenant. He identifies the law on both sides. He's willing to see it as having a sacramental character. All right? Further corroboration of this point is seen in the later argumentation of the Federalists, in which they follow this same line of reasoning as has just been gleaned from Calvin. For example, you might want to refer to Heinrich Heppe's Reformed Dogmatics. And you'll find these kind of point-by-point statements that we just found from Calvin's commentaries are part of the Federalists as they develop the notion of Adam's fall from the covenant of works. It's the same concepts being developed. The idea of a sacrament of the covenant, the idea of the temporary character of it, the importance of law and obedience, the continuity of the law, moral law in both eras. Okay, next paragraph. Because of the central role of the Decalogue and the innate law of nature in the development of Ursinus's covenant of nature, it has been indicated above that this same distinction is present in Calvin's thought. That is, we need to see it in the continuity. But further, in this context, the question of Calvin's use of the fetus legale must be considered. Because I think this is probably the most potent argument that for those from the continental historical school we're looking at can present. And that is, does Calvin ever use the phrase a covenant of law to describe the pre-fall situation? And it seems to me I have to say that it is only in the barest inference that he does. And that is probably their most important argument. I'm going to show that there's a sense in which proleptically he's moving in that direction, but I don't think we can say beyond a shadow of a doubt he did it, okay? And so I'm trying to say that this, if you will, is probably what Ursinus' movement was. Calvin painted the picture of a different covenant based upon obedience, had the sacramental qualities. He calls it a covenant. It's distinct from the covenant of grace. The moral law is the same, but the moral law, when it's given explicitly with Moses, he uniquely calls it the covenant of law as a historical redemptive era. It's really with Ursinus that phrase naturally is taken over and describes that pre-fall covenant that Calvin had already developed. That is a development, but not inventing something new that came from Melanchthon, but rather a natural extension that was implicit in Calvin's own thought. Okay, Now let me try to explain to you where I see this movement. Okay, while Althaus and Sturm have asserted that Calvin does not relate this with a fetus creationis, but only with the Mosaic covenant, the fact remains that Calvin sees a great consonance between the pre-fall relationship and Moses' proper office as lawgiver in the covenant of law has just been discussed. So that's part of the earlier context. In addition, Calvin is able to conceive of the covenant of the law as existing even in Abram's day, long before Moses' work as lawgiver. Now, what I'm saying here is that we can find an example in Calvin's thought where he uses the phrase the covenant of the law in a proleptic sense and takes it from Mosaic time and moves it even to be somehow at work in Abram's time, which is significantly earlier in redemptive history, which argues that Calvin sees it moving in some kind of a figurative sense, broader, and that with that movement already underway, it's very natural for his students. By the way, Ursinus was a student of Calvin. I forgot to tell you, since we haven't read this whole article together yet, that actually Ursinus was saved in a drowning accident. I don't know if you knew this, but he was almost drowned one time. And as he was bobbing in the waters, his prayer was, Lord, if you save me, I promise to become a student of Calvin's writings. Isn't that interesting? That's a true story. And so when we talk, that's almost like Luther, right? Except instead of patronage to St. Anne, it would be to St. John, right? St. John Calvin. The point is that Ursinus, of course, becomes a president of a Reformed theological school, committed himself to the study of Calvin's writings, even though he was very close to Melanchthon. So you see that the idea, where would Ursinus have learned of Calvin's thinking? Because he pledged his life to the study of Calvin, okay? Where could he have learned the ideas of the covenant works? If he read his Genesis commentary, I think the whole concept is there. If he read his exposition of the sacraments, the notion is there. The question is, had anybody developed these seminal thoughts into a system? Not quite yet. In fact, Ursinus doesn't even completely develop it, because that catechism does not become the dominant teaching tool. The Heidelberg comes along and takes more prominence, and so that idea is there, and it takes more work before it takes its strength in Reformed theology. But the point is, we don't have to look to Melanchthon to find this. Natural law theology is in Calvin. We can also find the law-gospel distinction properly in Calvin, but interpreted in a Reformed system, and that even the very structure of the covenant of works is in Calvin. Now, listen to this quote, and just to give you a little feeling for this proleptic use of the idea of the fetus legale. Quoting Calvin now, and let's see if I remember where we're quoting from. This is a commentary on Genesis 15:6. Okay, so we're just reading the commentary in Genesis. The argument of Paul is of this kind. The circumcision of Abram was posterior to his justification in the order of time, and therefore could not be its cause, for of necessity the cause precedes its effect. I also grant that Paul for this reason contends that works are not meritorious except under the covenant of the law, of which covenant circumcision is put as the earnest and the symbol. Okay, so what he's saying is that law is represented by Moses by circumcision, and the covenant of law is under Moses. Okay? But since Paul is not here defining the force and nature of circumcision regarded as a pure and genuine institution of God, but is rather disputing on the sense attached to it by those with whom he deals, he therefore does not allude to the covenant which God before had made with Abram, because the mention of it was unnecessary for the present purpose. Both arguments are therefore a force. First, that the righteousness of Abram cannot be ascribed to the covenant of the law, because it preceded his circumcision. And secondly, that the righteousness even of the most perfect characters perpetually consists in faith. Now what I'm suggesting there is that Calvin is beginning to bring together the notion of the works righteousness issue of the Sinaitic covenant and playing it off in the life of Abram and saying that we cannot appeal to the law covenant in Abram's life in his circumcision because his faith preceded it. And so it's kind of like the idea that circumcision somehow included in it the idea of the coming moral law under Moses. Now, that's not an airtight argument. I'm saying you see a movement of thought that brings together. Now, in my dissertation, I go on to point out that there's even a further extension of this in his Jeremiah commentary, where you can actually see him moving the same kind of thing with Adam and Sinai. There's a point where he brings, it's not now Sinai and Abram, but actually Sinai and Adam. And there's some parallels that are fascinating. But I cannot find any place where Calvin ever will say, well, this is a covenant of law. He doesn't do that. For him, the phrase uniquely is, in its proper sense, what happens at Sinai. But my response to that is that that's a good point, but it is not, it doesn't destroy everything else that Calvin developed that is covenantal, which he calls a covenant. Okay? We don't find the explicit use. We find maybe some anticipated movement of thought. But everything else that we're looking for to have a covenant of works, in essence, is already in Calvin. Now, I hope you'll read the article and look at it more fully on your own. But to review then, okay, when you're looking at this argument, the first question is, of the three usages of Melanchthonian theology, give me 3 minutes and I'll summarize. Can we find an exclusive use of natural law in Melanchthon that's not found anyone else? No. You find it in Luther. You can find the same concept in Calvin. And therefore, it's illegitimate to call those concepts Melanchthonian natural law, because whatever there is of continuity between natural law and Ten Commandments and the impact of sin, you can find both concepts equally used in Calvin and Melanchthon. Secondly, there is a law-gospel distinction in Calvin that operates in the conversion experience of law that changes for the Christian. That doesn't work in the tradition of Luther. It maintains its power. It changes for Calvin. But it still is there. And to the extent that it's there, we can look at that same system and apply it directly to what Calvin develops. Adam, in his experience, is living under a law covenant. There is a law requirement in a temporary period that's distinct from the covenant that will follow it. There is a law gospel analysis of history that Calvin is prepared to use. And so, and that's consistent with Reformed theology, because Adam was not being saved by a redeemer. He was being saved by keeping the law requirement. Obedience would bring him to life. That's precisely what we need for a covenant of works. So my conclusion then, very simply put, is that while there are Melanchthonian influences, they are not uniquely Melanchthonian in character. They are found equally in Calvin, and in fact, the express character of the idea of two focal points of history of God dealing differently is beautifully presented in Calvin's own teaching. So why would we have to look elsewhere and say they come from Melanchthon? Because his commentaries on Genesis portray this kind of historical movement. So my sense is, as I conclude, is that there is a common heritage that Ursinus can pick up from both Melanchthon and Calvin, but uniquely the character of the covenant of works developed by Ursinus is actually simply expanding a concept that Calvin had already developed but had not given what later theologians recognized as far more significance than he had developed it for. So there was an elevated importance given it to later, but not a new concept. It's already there. So my conclusion then is, yes, Ursinus is the first developer of the covenant of creation, but it is not a debt to Melanchthon. He may have been influenced by Melanchthon, but they were common coinage that all of the Reformation could use. But for the real explicit concepts, they were readily available in Calvin in what I call an inchoate covenant of works, a beginning form. Calvin didn't develop, but it's there. Okay? Stop. See you in 2 weeks.